My name is Marie Fisher. I'd like to welcome you all to the Women on Wednesday series, Still Fighting for Our Rights 30 Years Later. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones and pagers and stay in your seats quietly until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. Please join the Women's Center tonight at 6 p.m. in the Cascade Room for the Women's History Month and Sexual Assault Awareness Month keynote speaker, Lori Robinson. She will discuss her own experiences of sexual assault and racism in this culture. Also, there are still scholarship applications available at the back table, along with other event information. Our session today is titled Women, Media, and Pop Culture. Americans consume media an inordinate amount of time each day, but studies reveal that both women and men downplay the power and influence it has over our lives. The complex, wealthy, and powerful U.S. media continue to cause complications for women in terms of realistic, healthy, and multifaceted representations of real women in all forms of media. Our presenter will talk about representations of women in the media and the importance of women being in leadership positions. Dr. Beth Barilla is the Director of Women's Studies Program at SCSU. Here, her areas of teaching and research include feminist theory, gender and women's studies, LGBT studies, popular culture, environmental justice, and community-based arts. Dr. Barilla completed her doctorate at Syracuse University in 2001. Her interests include public art as a form of social change and in popular culture, as a contested space around representations of gender, race, class, and sexuality. Dr. Barilla has presented regularly at the American Studies Association Conference and at other national and regional conferences. Her current community interests involve community-based arts and activities that address anti-racism efforts and women's and LGBT issues. We are very grateful to have her with us here today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Dr. Beth Barilla.
Thank you, Marie and Jane Olson and everyone else from the Women's Center. Thank you all for being here. I, again, am Beth Barilla. And I want to give a little plug for all the events for Women's History Month. The Women's Center has done a really fabulous job, as it always does, of organizing programming. There's a little bit left, and then there's some coming up that you'll see flyers around. So please take advantage of that. I'll also let you know about the Women's Studies program. There are some summer courses being offered, and the flyers are in the back. So they asked me to talk about women, media, and culture, and one of my favorite things to do is study popular culture. I'm one of those people who talks at movie screens and movie theaters. So the Women's Center planned a series of talks this semester around the 1977 Plan of Action from the National Women's Conference, and this is in your flyer for Women on Wednesday, so you've probably heard about it, but I thought I'd just refresh our memory quickly about how they framed this talk, and I'll be touching on some of these ideas. So this is right from the Women's Center brochure. The media should employ women in all job categories and especially in policy-making positions. They should make affirmative efforts to expand the portrayal of women, to include a variety of roles, and to represent accurately the numbers of lifestyles of women in society. So a couple of points here that I thought I'd touch on have to do with the issue of representation. Who's in decision-making power? Who's deciding what stories we see, what films we watch, what music we hear? And also, what kinds of roles are available for women artists and artists of color and LGBT artists, as well as this issue of a variety of roles to represent accurately the numbers of lifestyles of women in society. That is, do the portrayals we see really reflect the range of lives that women lead, or do they portray just a very narrow subset? And then, more importantly, what's the effect of those portrayals? And then the Women's Center brochure poses these two questions. In what ways have women achieved equal opportunity, liberation, and gender equity? And in what ways have we not? Which women have achieved more equality? And how do race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, class, nationality, ability, religion, and marital status affect the equality quotient? This part is one of the things we're going to talk about today. We're going to look at some images and learn to analyze what kinds of messages they're sending. And one of the key elements of the Women's Studies program here, as well as the work that the Women's Center does, is not to generalize about all women and men as though we're one category, but instead look at how economic class, race, ethnicity, sexual identity, physical ability, religion, national location all affect and create different experiences for us, and therefore have different effects in power dynamics. So we're going to take up some of these issues. And I'm going to leave some time for a little question answer at the end of the session, but if anybody has had me in class, y'all know I'm a little punchy, and I like interactive presentations, so I am not going to talk at you for 40 minutes. What I'd like you to do is take maybe 2 to 3 minutes, turn to the neighbor next to you, introduce yourself, and talk about these two questions. What images of women do you see in the media, whatever media you watch or consume, listen to, purchase? And what images would you like to see? So what images of women do you see, and what images do you like to see? So turn to your neighbor and mingle. All right, that's fascinating how you all do that sort of simultaneously. There's like this party lull whenever you do that. Okay, so I'm just going to get a couple of the ideas that you brainstormed, and then we can come back to them later throughout the presentation. So what are some of the images that you do currently see in the media that you consume? Anyone?
Sexploitation.
Sexploitation, absolutely. What else? Barbie, yes. You know who wouldn't be able to stand up if she were actually, you know, life-size. Or have real kidneys. What else? I'm sorry? Rich party girls. Okay, so economic class as well as particular behaviors that we see. Okay. Anything else? How about images you would like to see that maybe you don't as often as you'd like?
Real.
Okay, I like that. Anything else? Things you have to search out. You can't just turn on the television or, you know, turn on popular music stations and hear what you want to hear or see what you want to see.
Less objectification of women based upon their
body. Okay, less objectification of women based upon their body parts. I like that too. And I saw another hand. Women in more political power. Nice. That goes back to the media plank that we talked about. Are they in decision-making positions? But also, are we seeing a range of women in powerful positions? Notice the West Wing, the television show, was on for a long, long, long time, won lots of awards. The one with Gina Davis came and went like that. In fact, you might even be going, what? You know, because you didn't really know about it. So again, what kinds of positions do we see? So before I move on, let me just make sure. Can y'all hear me? Is that all right? Okay, well, I want to kind of frame our talk with some feminist cultural analysis. This is a scholar who wrote Material Girls. If you take my class on pop culture this summer, which I'm shamelessly promoting on a flyer that's being handed out, this is one of the books that I'll use. And she writes, quote, "Women are also in the strange and unique position of being spectators, consumers of their very own image, their very own objectification. At the same time that we witness our own representation, we are also so often denied a place in the process of that representation, denied a voice, so that more often than not, those images of ourselves that stare at us from the glossy pages of women's magazines are not of our own creation. So again, this idea that I'm a woman viewer, and as I turn on TV, as I watch films, as I listen to music stations, I'm consuming images that objectify women. I'm consuming my own objectification, and that has effect on me. Although if you see me driving on 94, you'll also see me yelling at my radio at various times. So I am talking back in some ways to the images, and that's one of the things that we'll talk about in this talk, how you can critically consume it. But part of the issue of representation has to do with how many women, how many people of color, how many people in the LGBT communities have some control over what images get out there, what images are reflecting their own communities. That becomes an issue when you study popular culture. So one of the things that the media plank that I started this presentation with talks about is this idea of equality in the media. So I'm just going to go over some of the current statistics or recent statistics of women's representation in the media. A 2001 study reported that women constitute only 10% of executive positions in the most prominent media companies. And if you do any pop culture or media studies, you probably will know that a very small number of corporations control the largest number of mainstream media outlets. So you have quite a monopolization of media access, and that controls what we can see. Within that monopoly of media access, women are only 10% of executive positions and only 3% of CEO or president positions. Women constitute only 12% of media corporate boards. A 1998 study showed that major network news featured women as expert commentators in their fields only 13% of the time, while male experts were 87% of the time. And again, when we constantly see those images, men presented as experts, women rarely there, we get these messages that women don't know what they're talking about, right? Even though women are experts in a variety of fields. This source, Girls, Women, and Media Project, as well as many other useful sources, are on the flyer so that you can follow up on some of this information. Women held a 9-to-1 ratio of men to women in commentators on top Sunday news shows. And the International Women's Media Foundation reported that 98% of women journalists said they faced gender discrimination in their careers. So again, women are making a lot of progress. We see more and more women in the media. We see more and more women in powerful positions. We see more and more women and communities of color having some say over what stories we hear in the media. That said, there's still a long way to go. There's still gender discrimination. And this resource, International Women's Media Foundation, is a really great resource. You might want to check it out. That also is on your flyer. If you don't know about the Guerrilla Girls, you might have some fun with them. I certainly do. This is a billboard they created. They're an artistic media feminist commentary, and this is directly from them. Here are the embarrassing Hollywood statistics. Of 2002's top grossing 100 films, 4% had female directors, 8% had female writers, 1% had female cinematographers, and 12% had female editors. And while our government has a long way to go in gender equity, the film industry has a lot further to go. This is another one of their posters, the anatomically correct Oscar. He's white and male, just like the guys who win. And it says, come on, that's kind of funny. And it says, here are a few stats. Hollywood guilds are 80 to 90% white. No people of color employed by movie studios have the power to greenlight movies. Four of the 44 partners or board members at the town's top five talent agencies are women. None of the 44 people are people of color. So again, that's changing over time, and there are certainly venues. There's Women Make Movies and other kinds of corporations that are specifically trying to create access for people of marginalized groups, but there's a long way to go. So I'm a pop culture scholar. That means when I watch movies, it's work, which is great fun. And there are some things that we need to think about when we do a feminist cultural analysis of popular culture. One has to do with representation, how many women are in the media in decision-making positions. We just touched on that very briefly. But we also want to analyze what is, what kinds of portrayals are out there, what are the patterns of portrayal, because it's not just one ad or one film or one song. We're looking at patterns. Does this example fit into a pattern of portrayals? Which women are portrayed, how and by whom? And more importantly, what are the effects of those portrayals? What messages do they send? And finally, we don't just want to critique what is, we want to change what is. So what are some alternative, more positive portrayals? I love that image. She's reading the Wonder Woman. So from a feminist perspective, media images both reflect and produce dominant belief systems about gender. So nothing gets produced and continues to be produced if it doesn't sell. We wouldn't have Survivor 500 or Rocky 300 if the first two didn't sell, right? So it taps into something in culture. So it's reflecting ideas in culture, but by continuing to be prominent, it's continuing to produce those ideas. And therefore, we learn gendered codes from the media. We learn what it means to be male, female, masculine, feminine, etc. The media is not the only source that we learn that from. We also learn it from the government, the family, the educational system, our community, etc. But the media is one very visible and prominent role. This is a Barbara Kruger image. She's a feminist artist. It says, "We have received orders not to move." I also love that one. And I just want to tell you some of the assumptions that I'm coming into this from because of my background in women's studies. I understand that gender is socially produced. It's not natural. We don't pop out of the womb wanting to wear a hot pink prom gown if we're women. We're taught that. We learn how to be men and women. And what we learn is shaped by our race, our economic location, our sexual identity, and our national location. And so when you analyze popular culture, you need to look at a couple different things. And I'm assuming that people in this room are coming from a lot of different backgrounds, which is why I'm very briefly touching on some different aspects. I'm also condensing an entire semester's class in 50 minutes, so bear with me. We need to look at the text. We also need to look at the socio-political context. And we need to look at audience reception. Meaning exists in all of those together. And together, they create messages about gender. So when we look at the text, we need to look at what images are included and which ones are not included. We need to look at camera angles. We need to look at the text. What are the ad slogans? What's the plot narrative in films? You know, that sort of thing. What dialogue do people engage in? We need to look at where it appears. Does it appear in Cosmopolitan? Does it appear in a feminist magazine? Does it appear in Essence, which is a magazine targeted African American women? And therefore, who is the target audience, right? Britney Spears, when I was teaching a course in Syracuse, I taught a senior seminar course and had to learn way more about Britney Spears than I wanted to because one of my students did a presentation on her. But her target audience, and that was maybe 8 years ago, was like pre-adolescent girls, right? And so not women her age, but much younger, and that says something. And then models, who's present and who's absent. Often who is absent is just as important as who's present. And then whose perspective is included and whose is excluded. And that, again, is why we talk about who's in decision-making power. When we talk about socio-political context, we want to talk about what's happening in society at any given moment. What are the historical patterns of representation of a particular social group? So again, it's not just one film or one image or one song. It's how does that particular example fit into a pattern of portrayals? What power dynamics do the images reflect, produce, and perpetuate? And then what is the text referencing? Is it commenting on other ads? Is it historical or current? How many of you saw Pulp Fiction? Anybody? It's a little dated. You know, when John Travolta's up there doing his twist thing, they're counting on the fact that you all knew his dance, Saturday Night Fever thing, right? They're hoping that you as the audience are kind of connecting what other references they're trying to make there. And then audience response. How do different audiences respond? That's really important. If you look at how a particular text can be really a film or a movie or a song, can be really popular in one community, while another community says, wow, that's really offensive, right? That's really problematic. That tells us something about social power dynamics. It tells us something about community relations in society. We also want to think about how our identity locations affect our interpretations, and what different interpretations are created. And then in that contestation, in those different responses that circulate around any given pop culture text, what does that tell us about society? And when we add all that together, we get points about gender, about race, about class, about sexual identity, about national location. This is that feminist cultural studies scholar again, and she wrote, quote, the entire cultural notion of woman is itself constructed in and through images, rather than somehow residing in the images themselves. So again, this is that idea that images don't just reflect what we think, they continue to produce what we think. We learn things from those messages, and therefore they produce ideas about women, and that's the so what of why we study them. That's why it's important to study them. Okay, I'm going to throw a couple quick statistics at you, and then we're going to look at some images. And I'm going to whip through these, so you're not going to be able to write them down, but they are on the About Face website that's on the flyer that I handed out. Why study pop culture? Well, because we live in an image-saturated society. The average adolescent watches 3 to 4 hours of television per day, and I'm assuming this is within the United States. 4 hours of television programming contains about 100 ads. In 1992, the 10 most popular magazines commonly read by men and women were reviewed for their articles on weight loss. And the women's magazines contained 10.5 times more articles related to dieting and weight than did men's. Now, that's changing. Men are increasingly becoming targeted by these same kinds of ads. This is also important that as women moved into more and more professional and managerial positions in the 20s and the 60s, so as women were making progress in professional fields, the images of women as hyper slim, super duper slim, were also increasing. So, and remember, not taking up a lot of space, slimness, is another way of containing women, right? So as women were gaining more power in the workplace, they were being more and taking up less and less space in terms of physical bodily space in pop culture. And a pop culture scholar would say, that's interesting. There's a relationship between those two things. The average person sees between 400 and 600 ads per day. That's 40 to 50 million by the time she's 60. And a lot of these have to do with messages about beauty. And then finally, 30% of local TV news time is devoted to advertising. 2001, U.S. advertising expenditures topped $230 billion, which doubled since 1980. And we know, especially if you do women's studies or eating disorder studies, media images influence people's self-perception and self-esteem. And that's another one of the so what's. Why do we talk about this? That's another Barbara Kruger image that I love. Your body is a battleground. And again, the images tell us something about pop culture. I'm going to skip this because we've had trouble accessing the internet from here. But if you want to see some interesting new portrayals, you might check out the Dove campaign. And in the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead to some analyses. Well, maybe I'll engage you in some and then skip ahead a little bit later. So we've got two ads here. Can you all see the ads? Is it okay with the lights on? One is for a collagen filler, L'Oreal, and the other is for Olay. What stands out to you in these ads? Anything strike you? Beautiful skin. Okay, which means what? What constitutes beautiful skin?
A product.
Okay, you have to buy a product.
Or do something. Change yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You should do that.
Perfection. Yep. Okay. And the Dove little clip that I was going to show in the previous slide actually shows you what a top model goes through to be on the cover, right? All the makeup, all the hair, but then also all the computer altering, all the graphic altering of her face. So if you want to go, you can check that out. So some things to point out here. It says, as you mentioned, that women are not acceptable as they are. They need to purchase products in order to be acceptable. They need to alter things. And so that's a capitalist endeavor. We have to spend money, which means we have to have leisure and time. We have to have leisure time to work on makeup and exercise and that sort of thing. Increasingly, we're also being encouraged to move towards surgery or Botox or that sort of thing. I mean, look at, she's basically injecting herself, right? It's just a tube, but hello, visually, it suggests something else, right? And even makeover shows, if you watch television, the makeover, you know, before, after idea has been around for a long time, but just recently, they're actually moving into cosmetic surgery as the after, right? Literally cosmetic surgery. We fragment women's bodies into problem areas. Open any Cosmopolitan magazine, and they'll be like, oh, the problem butt, or something like that, and they'll tell you what exercises to do. And that encourages women to fragment our own bodies. Instead of seeing ourselves as a whole being, we see ourselves as partial. And that's very prominent here in this Oil of Olay ad. And it should be telling that it's a woman of color model. We only see her from the waist down. And the slogan says that women shouldn't apply ourselves unnecessarily. Again, really problematic in terms of women making progress in the workplace. You don't really need to apply yourself. And when you look at racial power dynamics combined with gender power dynamics, that sends a particular racist message. I'm going to jump ahead. These are two particular, this one gets me every time, a woman in a box. I'm still not entirely sure what the ad is trying to advertise, but I find it a particularly offensive ad. And what this suggests are a couple of different things. Woman as object, she's disembodied. It's dehumanizing. Not only is she fragmented, but she doesn't have a face, she doesn't have a voice, she doesn't have a mouth. We're supposed to want the Lexus, not necessarily her. She's silent, she's contained in both cases, literally spatially contained as well as, you know, wrapped up, and she's interchangeable. We can't tell her from any other woman, right? She has no voice, she has no specific identity, and same with this one down here. These are particularly interesting ones that I'm just going to touch on briefly as woman as object. This, some of you in my class have already heard me vent about. This was recently auctioned off on eBay for starting at $2,000. It's called the Bitch Cruiser. I probably don't need to say a whole lot about it, except that if you can't see it, it says sex machine down here. And then the top one is a man having sex with a woman with a car ad over her face. Also, and it's an ad for the car. Also, particularly telling, A, it's heteronormative, male-female heterosexual relations, but also he's more interested in the sexual action and the car rather than her as an individual being. Both of these objectify women and hypersexualize them as objects, not as beings. Anything you notice about this one? Fashion ad? Her dress is off, yes. So same ad, it's a spread, and we move from her clothed, but not a whole lot, still sexualized in both of them, to her not clothed. And the body language sends some power dynamics. The man's gaze is direct and it's strong, as is his pose, whereas the woman's submissive. She never looks at us directly, and he's actually leaning forward in the second one, right, whereas she's not. Her position is also contained in that she's sort of taking up very little space. He's clothed, whereas she's either nude or close to it. And both of these suggest that the man's in control and the woman is sexualized. And again, one ad. But if you start looking for this stuff in magazines, it's everywhere. Hypersexualization, also everywhere. As you pointed out, I'll whip through this pretty quickly, but we've got Beyonce, Britney Spears and her Toxic video, and the Pussycat Dolls. So women as sex objects, if you've done any work on women in the music industry, a lot of them have talked about how even if they're not hypersexualized when they first make it as hits, they are increasingly pressured to do so. So they're pressured to change their image if they're going to keep getting records made. So women as sex objects, in this ad, we've got, I don't know how many women actually wear their purses to bed, but this is what she's doing. And of course, we've got a man's head between her legs, hypersexual and heteronormative. One thing that we can point out, though, is that this ad appeared in Teen Vogue. So super young, you may not be able to see with the lights bright on it, but she's very, very young. And again, I mentioned Britney Spears being targeted to a very young audience. So we've got the hypersexualization of young girls and women, and we can see those everywhere, too. The Rolling Stone, with that cover was out, I want to say, 8 or 10 years ago. But we continue to see teen girls portrayed in a hypersexualized way, and increasingly even very, very young girls portrayed in sexualized ways. And again, depending on where you see these ads, like, you know, context, that also becomes an issue. So young girls and teens are hypersexualized. This is another one of the so whats, that young women are turned into sex objects but told not to be sexually active and in fact blamed if they are. So in an age in the United States where we're talking a lot about abstinence-only education, that women shouldn't be sexual, young girls shouldn't learn anything about their own sexuality, they walk out of the schoolhouse and, schoolhouse, listen to me, dating myself, they walk out of the school and they see these hypersexualized images everywhere. Those are contradictory messages that kind of put them in a bind. Which message do they get to follow? And in fact, neither one gives them much control over their own sexuality. And then, of course, the United States has a particularly high teen pregnancy rate, and we then blame the young women if they get pregnant without giving them actual information about it, but we do hypersexualize them. And then also, if you've done work in media studies, you learn a little bit about the ageism, especially for women. In the media industry, men become distinguished as they get older, women get old. And somehow that's a bad thing, right? So while young women under 20 are told to be older and hypersexualized, women over 30, which I don't know how many in here are over 30, but I'm 38 and I'm not past my prime, nevertheless, you're told to be increasingly younger. And that sort of narrows the margin for women. Violence against women, these are very, very disturbing images. This is the boxed-in one again, which I would say is super violent. But these two are from America's Next Top Model in March of 2007. How many of you have ever seen or heard of America's Next Top Model? Okay. Well, on that particular episode, all of the models were shot in corpse-like poses. That was the fashion shoot, corpse-like poses, play dead and be sexual and somehow beautiful. And they were incredibly graphic, incredibly disturbing. And there are several of them. I don't know, where I am, there's a lot of light glare, so I don't know if you can see this. This is, can we turn the front lights off? Is there any way to turn more lights off so that people can see this? This is a woman of color who is very graphically shot and murdered. So again, what is the link between dead women and fashion shoots, right? Why is that even something that we want to eroticize or glamorize or anything like that? We want to ask questions about that. So images of violence against women, they become normalized. That is, we see them so often that we tend not to even notice it. People don't ask questions like, why are we even thinking about, women as corpses as a fashion shoot? We eroticize violence against women. We conflate sex with violence. And again, if we learn messages from media, that's a really dangerous message to learn, especially when domestic violence and sexual assault is so such an epidemic in this world. And the constant presence of this violence then leads to a desensitization of viewers. We're so used to it that if we go to an Arnold Schwarzenegger film and there's no violence, we're going to be like, what? Right? I mean, we're so used to it that we expect it. And that, from a feminist point of view, is really problematic because it has real-life effects. These are also particularly problematic and violent imagery, racist imagery in the media. And again, it's because it's not just one ad. It fits into a pattern. This one is for paint, and it says, "Let me stand out and still be undercover." Why we need to write that on a woman of color's body to sell paint? What's the link here? The link is, racist imagery. This one is hypersexualized. If you do any studies of race imagery of women in mainstream U.S. media, very often women of color, if they're present at all, are linked with nature and somehow portrayed as hypersexual and animalistic. This one is particularly disturbing. It's a recent one to advertise a new restaurant in Rhode Island, and it says over her breast, "See what you've been missing." It participates in a long history of sort of orientalizing, traditional negative stereotypes of Asian American women. Again, her body's fragmented. She has no voice. She has no face. And why even use her body to advertise a restaurant? They've also, it's called Chinese Laundry, and there's several Asian American women groups who are protesting this ad campaign, in part because there's a history of racial discrimination that prevented Chinese immigrants from being in a lot of fields and pushed them into certain fields, including Chinese Laundry, which the restaurant doesn't even acknowledge by using that name. And the night that it opened, they had a way. They had one. What is a growing trend, which is literally sushi served on a woman's body, a real woman's body. And then when she leaves, an image of the woman appeared on the table. So again, a real objectification of women in sexist terms. What this and racist terms. What this suggests is that it perpetuates long-standing stereotypes about women of color. Women of color are often absent from mainstream U.S. media, which is increasingly why it's important to have women of color in decision-making power, deciding what images of women of color are in mainstream media, and also why there are alternative venues that particularly come out of communities of color so that they don't have to consume these images. When women of color do appear, they are often light-skinned and or hypersexualized. And a lot of these images together perpetuate racist power dynamics and thus the oppression of women of color. African American women are often linked with nature or portrayed in animalistic, quote-unquote, ways, and they are often hypersexualized and objectified through racist paradigms. While Asian American women and women of Southeast Asian descent are often exotified, primitivized, and linked to quote-unquote Orientalist or traditional cultural ideals, and by Orientalist I'm referring to Edward Said's theory, which I can talk to you more about later, and they are often portrayed as passive, submissive, and obedient, which we saw in the previous ad for the restaurant. So this is just a summary of the kinds of things that often sell. One thing that I haven't particularly touched on but I want to add to is that one thing that tends to sell is women's fear and vulnerabilities. And again, we have to ask questions about why that is. So the question becomes not so much what sexist images are produced, but how they are produced and come to have meaning for us. And it's that come to have meaning for us that tells us something about society. That, again, is Susanna Walters. That said, a feminist portrayal also looks at alternative portrayals. This is a famous Body Shop ad. Some of you may have seen it. We don't just want to critique what is. We also want to look at alternative portrayals, more positive ones. So one thing that these positive ones might do is critique existing ones, like this one does. That sort of makes a comment on the hypersexualization, the nudity of women that we often see. But it says something in particular about it. It says there are 3 billion women who don't look like supermodels and only 8 who do. So again, it's critiquing existing ones and presenting an alternative. Often they'll raise critical questions, these new versions. Such as the one, the Dove one that I mentioned, where it shows a fashion model going, you know, from looking normal to being, you know, graphically altered for the cover of a magazine. It would reflect a range of ages, body types, ethnicities, races, nationalities, physical abilities, and sexual identities. Again, creating a diversity of portrayals that reflects actually the diversity of women's lives. Challenge dominant belief systems, endorse women's intellect, athleticism, creative talents, and achievements rather than just their beauty or their sexual objectification. And keep in mind that these may still be problematic. So, for instance, there's, you know, the new Dove campaign has gotten a lot of good publicity, and it is being productive. It's also problematic in many ways. It's certainly not flawless. But one could argue that even if there are some flaws in some of these, they're still moving in a more productive direction. And so in the interest, and if anybody's interested, there is a magazine called Bitch, Feminist Response to Pop Culture. And, of course, they're reclaiming the word bitch. They're not using it in the way you might hear it on, you know, in the hallways. And you can get this magazine at a lot of independent bookstores, and it's actually a feminist analysis of a lot of popular culture. In the interest of time and y'all having a chance to ask some questions, I'm going to open this up. I do have some more positive images that I can sort of play behind me while we do this, if I can remember how to get the full screen here. Alt-Enter. Doesn't seem to want to do that. Well, anyway, while we're figuring this out, I'll go ahead and open it to comments or questions. We have about 10 minutes. Anybody want to add some comments or have any questions for the audience or for myself? Yep.
So the site is not consuming
Excellent question. Did y'all hear it? Besides not consuming sexist or racist imagery in pop culture, how can we be resistant? How can we either not participate in it or consume more positive imagery? That's a very good question. I guess I would suggest that in a capitalist society, where you put your money counts, and so searching out the more positive, the more alternative portrayals, and supporting them economically whenever possible, or at least by numbers, showing up at those films and that sort of thing, would help. So you're not just not buying the ones that are problematic, but you're supporting the ones that aren't. Letter writing campaigns, word of mouth, dialoguing with the people around you who watch things that you think are problematic. So again, raising awareness is one way of doing it. Does anybody have any other suggestions about how to be a kind of resistant consumer to pop culture? Things you can do besides just not participating in? If it's going to work, behind me will be some flashes of some slightly more positive portrayals. It was going to have an India RE soundtrack, but, technology and I are not cooperating today. Other questions or thoughts? Comments? So circulating in diverse communities, whether it's racial or economic or gendered or sexual identity or religion, national identity, to sort of call into question whatever habitual assumptions. Okay. What else? Yep.
I have a question.
Okay. Well, I might ask them why they're wearing a Tommy Hilfiger sweatshirt if media has no power over them, right? Or something like that. That it's so deeply ingrained. And one thing that I tell them, and it's not, I'm long-winded. It's not a two-sentence thing. But when I was back in college, I saw DreamWorlds, a video on music videos, and I don't sit in front of music videos and watch them from beginning. I don't watch hours of music videos, but I had seen every one of those videos, every one of them, because they're on in malls, they're on as I walk through residence halls, they're on, they're around me, whether I actively consume them or not. And so throwing out some statistics about when, that something like 3 to 5-year-old girls have already been on diets. Where do they learn that? They learn that somewhere, right? And it does have some effects. I'm not suggesting that eating disorders and media are the only causation, but there is a role there. Yep.
If this is what they're always trying to sell
up, yep.
What are we shooting for them not to sell? Like, how do we encourage them not to sell this stuff?
The question was, if this is what we're always being sold, how do we encourage them not to sell that, and what do we want to be sold? Is that...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that goes back to... I'm sorry, your name? Wangari's question. I think, again, really supporting the things that are positive, the things that provide at least a more complex range. So, for instance, how many of you saw the film Smoke Signals? Sherman Alexie? Okay. One person besides me. It was a really phenomenal film. Sherman Alexie is a Native writer. It was predominantly produced and directed and acted in by Native American men and women. And again, it was one of the first widely released that did that, and it told a much more complex story, right, than ones that we tend to see in mainstream media. But look around, you're still not seeing a lot more of those, right? And you sometimes had to search it out. So again, trying to pressure media outlets to, you know, have more of that available so that we can at least see the complex range of things.
Would you consider what they're doing brainwashing, in a sense? I know that sounds a little bit extreme, but I guess they are.
You think they are brainwashing? Okay. I would use a different word than brainwashing, but it's along similar lines. It goes back to the idea of us learning these messages, and media perpetuates and participates in that process. It's not the only part of it, but certainly it's one place where we learn a lot. So one of the ways that I think we can really resist the system is by becoming critical viewers, right? Which is why I'm known for yelling at my radio when I have the country music station on. I'm just like, what? you know, again, because when you, it doesn't mean you can't enjoy some things, but when you become critical viewers, you can raise these questions so that even if you can't completely stop the objectification right now, you can, in any case, not consume it so uncritically. And I grew up, my mother used to buy me Cosmopolitan in high school. So every month I would be like, ooh, what new eyeshadow am I supposed to buy today? You know, and again, it's this consumer thing, right? And now here I am a feminist, so it can happen. but again, I didn't have that kind of critical insight at the time, and I think developing it is how, one way. Mm-hmm. And you clearly do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we are all gendered, and we're gendered in particular ways. And so women get one set of messages, and it's shaped by which women we're talking about, race, class, sexual identity, national location. Men get targeted by other messages, and again, it's shaped by which men we're talking about. But men learn those messages too. And if any of you have seen the film Tough Guys by Jackson Katz, he talks about the role of masculinity and violence and the way that that participates in this, and also the kind of costs for men. That we all have an investment in changing these portrayals. Good question. I think we have time for maybe one or two more. I think that there will be different outtakes or outlooks on gender roles because there are now than when I was born. I mean, it's increasingly changing. It changes all the time. I don't know if I personally want gender roles necessarily to change. Evaporate. I want them to be more open and less attached to power dynamics. That's my personal opinion. Other people may have different perspectives on that. But I'm not so much interested in seeing gender roles or gender itself disappear. I'm interested in seeing it open so that people can be whatever genders they want to be and play whatever gender roles they feel inclined to do and not have discrimination of power dynamics attached to that. But people may have different opinions. One more question? Anybody else? All right, well, if you're interested in this, please think about taking the summer class or talking with me about women's studies. And thank you for attending.